Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think what I found writing this book is that there are two answers to the question of where is home. One of them is a very long, complicated answer, and I suppose this book is my attempt to offer that answer. And the other is a simple one, because most people, if you ask them where is home, can give you that answer in a sentence or in a word or a couple of words. And by the end of writing it, I suppose I felt much more able to do that than I had in the past. If somebody asks me where is home, I will say Shetland. At the moment, I live in Glasgow, but if somebody asks me where is home, it's not Glasgow, it is Shetland.
How do we know when we find our place in the world? Can a sense of belonging be defined? And does all geography begin inside? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to travel across countries, cities and unique locations on the 68 parallel to unravel the meaning and value of home. This evening, I'm joined by writer, journalist and musician Malachy Talloch, whose first book, 60 Degrees North, Around the World in Search of Home, unpacks the big questions in life. And in doing so, takes the reader on a soulful and emotional journey from Shetland to Greenland, from Alaska to Siberia, from St. Petersburg to Finland, to Sweden and Norway, mixing psychogeography, memoir and cultural history. In 60 Degrees North, Malachy writes, people come to Alaska for many different reasons. In Inalchik, they come to catch big fish. Other people travel to see wilderness, that vague, indefinable thing they feel is missing from their own lives. They come to experience nature, to gaze at it or move through it, and then to go home. There is a kind of nostalgia in this, a desire to return and to connect to something that is lost or in the process of being lost. It is a longing for the country's past, for an imagined American Eden, pre-Columbus and pre-Bering. To visit the wilderness is to cross out of history and into the perpetual present. In Gary Snyder's words, a way of life attuned to the slower and steadier processes of nature. That crossing, for some who come to live here, represents freedom. It's a chance to escape from the rules and bureaucracy and from the noise and the muddle of the modern world. Some people come to Alaska because they dream of the place and the dream won't let them go. So what is placefulness? And is home a contradiction of the heart?
Hello, I'm Malachy Talloch. I'm a singer-songwriter and an author. I've just published a book called Undiscovered Islands, about islands once believed to be real but that are no longer on the map. And I previously published a book called 60 Degrees North.
What a wonderful book, Malachy, 60 Degrees North. It's poetic in parts, it's very philosophical, there is superb cultural history in it. I might start with a big wide open question, if that's okay for you. Does landscape inhabit us in some way? Do you think landscape can be in one way central to our character and who and what we are or what we think?
It can be, I think, particularly for people who live in rural areas and in places where the climate and the landscape still impose themselves on your daily life, I suppose. So growing up in Shetland, of course, the landscape was a hugely important part of day-to-day life. And I think that over time you develop a relationship with landscape and with place that can be very difficult to put into words, but it's a very interesting thing to explore nonetheless.
Malachy, you describe the 68 parallel as a kind of border where the almost north and the north comes together. And I think somewhere else you say the 68 parallel cannot be defined. So I'm just wondering about that, how you went about understanding it all.
Well, it was a very gradual process, I suppose, throughout the process of travelling and kind of coming to an understanding of these places. I mean, the 60th parallel is an arbitrary line in a sense. It's a man-made creation. And yet, when you look at it on a map, it does seem in some ways to connect the two parts of the north together. So it runs along the very far south of some very northern places like Alaska and Greenland and the Nordic countries. And at the very far north of some more southerly places such as the British Isles.
You write also that geography begins at the only point of which it can be certain. It begins in sight. Do you think in some way we're all looking, no matter whether we live in the close to the Arctic Circle, whether it's London, New York, New Delhi, that we're all looking for a place of belonging, and that that necessarily doesn't mean the place that we grew up in?
I'm not sure that we all are. I think that a lot of people simply don't have much of a sense of attachment to place these days. I mean, capitalism in our modern day culture does not encourage a faithfulness to place. It doesn't encourage a deepened relationship with place. And perhaps a lot of people have a sense of missing something and they're not always quite sure what it is. And some people are lucky and they do find a strong connection with a particular place, which may not be the place that they grew up in or that they were born in. That's certainly the case for me. But a lot of people perhaps do feel that strong sense of connection with their home place, the place where they were born. But some people may never feel that longing, perhaps. And maybe they're lucky, I suppose.
Yeah, you pitch up a very interesting question. You say, are you right? Can we ever truly be home? And home means so much, so many different things to so many different people, whether you come at it from a cultural, spiritual, or even just down to kind of genetic understanding of home. And it's not a given, sure it's not.
No, absolutely not. And I think for a lot of people, home is simply where their family is or where their friends are and where they make human connections. But it can't be more complicated than that. It can be much wider than that too.
I was describing 60 degrees north to one of my best friends and I was saying it's very much like this, it's like that. And it was hard to actually say, is the book a memoir? Is it about psychogeography or is it cultural history? So how would you describe the book for anyone who hasn't read 60 degrees north?
Well, I suppose, like lots of writers, I'm sort of resistant to the idea of putting it in any particular box or category. I mean, when I started out, I thought it was just going to be a travel book. That was it. I was satisfying a certain curiosity about the place where I lived. But as I traveled and as I wrote, it obviously grew into something different from that. So it has that element. Of course, I talk about the histories and the cultures of the places where I visit, but it does become more personal. It does become partly about me and my own relationship with my home, as well as other people's relationship with their home. So, yeah, I mean, travel memoir, yes, but I'm sort of happy for it not to sit in any particular category at all.
As I was charting the different countries and different towns that you're visiting in, it struck me, what would the world have been like if we didn't have maps? Because it's almost hard to understand, really, isn't it? When we think that in the 14th and 15th century, all these explorers are finding different parts of the world. Like if we look at Scandinavia and so on, how lots of different islands were not on the map even at some stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to imagine ignorance. I suppose that's the thing. You can't unimagine all the things that you already know. So that idea of exploring without knowing what's going to be there, it's very difficult for us now. But at the same time, even when you have a map, even when you've read lots of books about a particular place before you go there, you don't know how it's going to feel until you get there. And I think that sense of how a place feels was part of what I wanted to explore in the book.
Yeah, you certainly can't feel much off a map. And when you think about it, it is the lived experience when you travel to any given place. You bring up the writings of British poet and novelist Lawrence Durrell, and he developed the idea of the invisible constant. I suppose in essence, what he was saying there was a thread that holds the history of a place together. Do you believe in all of that, Maliki? I find it fascinating, but it's kind of haunting as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And at a certain very basic degree, it's actually obvious. I mean, the climate and the landscape and the natural resources of a particular place absolutely shaped the kind of human cultures that developed there. Of course it did. It shaped the things that people ate and the way that they found their food. And that was true until relatively recently, I suppose. But part of what we've done since the Industrial Revolution really is to kind of push that aside. We no longer need to rely on the natural resources of our own area in the same way that we did before. We can find things from other places. And so we can ignore our places more than we ever could in the past.
Now, Malachy, you travel from Shetland to Greenland to Canada, Alaska, Siberia, St. Petersburg, Finland, Sweden, and I think Norway. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Greenland, your chapter on Greenland, I found fascinating. One of the things I hadn't realised is, and you mentioned it in the book, and, you know, we're living in the 21st century where we have Wi-Fi, we're also connected. But in Greenland, there's no roads between the communities. All public transport is by boat and helicopter. I was quite surprised by that, but I suppose the climate and the terrain is quite harsh, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and there are very few roads outside of towns, that's right. The sea is the main way of getting from one place to another during the summer months, and in the winter you could travel by skidoo or dog sled. In some ways the winter is the easiest way to get from place to place. But it is very strange coming from a country where it is so easy to get around, really, where places are so connected, to go somewhere like that, where each community, in a sense, is its own island.
The Greenlandic people believe that land belongs to all of them. It's a collective. They're in a communal experience with each other. And one of the things that they have been quite criticised from, or their cultural systems have been quite criticised, is their hunting traditions. I know that they do kill a lot of sea animals, whales and seals and so on. So how did you wrestle with that? I know, Malachy, you brought up one of the local politicians who said that, you know, other countries have failed to understand nature and our place within it, and that the Greenlandic people see the killing of animals as part of natural living systems, part of the evolutionary experience of life. So their philosophy runs so against the animal rights philosophy that predominates today. How did you understand it, or were your views challenged in any way by this?
My views were certainly challenged to a certain extent, yes. I mean, the contemporary ideas in Europe, the kind of animal rights ideas, are very much a sort of individualist way of looking at things. Animals are important because of their individual lives. And from that perspective, the killing of wild animals, of polar bears and seals and so on, can be a bit troubling for a lot of people. And what the Greenlanders say is that there's a massive hypocrisy going on here, because it's us in Europe and North America who are responsible for poisoning the oceans and poisoning the atmosphere on a mass scale. And all they're doing is killing to eat, which is what they've always done and what every other animal does, I suppose.
One of the things that I found quite sad when I was reading through your chapter on Greenland was how the social disintegration that's affecting Greenland today. You mentioned that there's a lot of teenage pregnancies, drug abuse, a lot of alcohol-related social problems. And I think one social worker mentioned to you that in some ways that the pace of change and the pace of life has accelerated so much that they have moved from a very traditional way of life to modern life so very quickly that there has been no space, personal space, for that type of transition. And it has really disrupted the culture in so many ways that people have turned to alcohol and drugs and so on as a coping mechanism, because they're in this whole new reality now that they maybe cannot properly realise yet.
That's right. I mean, in 2-3 generations, people in Greenland have gone from a very traditional way of life to kind of being forced into living in towns and trying to earn money rather than trying to find their own food. And so the whole society has been completely turned over, and the roles that people had within that society have been overturned. And it has been too quick, really. People have not been able to deal with it particularly well. There are very large instances of these problems, as you mentioned. And that's not unique to Greenland, of course. You find that in other native peoples in North America and in Australia and so on. But it has been particularly quick, that change in Greenland. And so it does seem to be particularly acute there, those problems.
Do you think it's too strong to say, Maliki, that in some ways modern life, technology, education, and what we all see is the advancements in society have in some way become their greatest threat?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in fact, it's difficult to see a satisfactory way forward for those people. Some of the people I spoke to in Greenland were quite optimistic. And the thing that they pointed to as being, I suppose, that the savior for people was education. People needed to get better education, and then they would be able to create work and find work and so on. But there is a problem with that, which is that living somewhere like Greenland, the more education you get, the further away you are taken from your home. So you can go to primary school in your village, but to go to secondary school, you have to go to the bigger town up the coast. And then if you want to go to college, you have to go to the capital, or to university, you have to go to Copenhagen. So every stage in that education, you're being taken further and further away from your home. And the idea that all of these people are then going to go back and create jobs within their communities, to me, is not very realistic. And so there is this kind of conflict or tension, I suppose, between these communities and the education system. And I don't see an easy way out of that.
You write about the freedom that exists in the wild spaces of Canada, and you create some beautiful visual pictures. I might compliment you on that. You met with a very interesting guy, Francois Paulette. Can you tell me about him? He seems to have an extraordinary capacity and understanding of life.
Yes, well, he was one of a group of First Nations people in Canada who several decades ago trained as lawyers because they saw that the only way that they were going to get justice for their people was through the legal system. But as well as having that education, he still is very much embedded within a kind of traditional life to the extent that it's still lived in Canada. So he's a very impressive character and quite an imposing character in some ways, and a challenging person to speak to. But he has a very strong and a very definite idea of what is needed for the First Nations people there.
He said something extraordinarily beautiful to you. He said, when I'm out on the river, I thank the river. And Dene culture is very much about that kind of spiritual relationship with the land. That is all about respect and gratitude and interdependence and interconnectedness. When you spent time there with him and some First Nations people, how did you understand the cultural genocide that has taken place of the First Nations people? Because there's so much information out there, some of it is very conflicting. But it is a very shameful history, what has been done to the Dene people, isn't it?
It is a very shameful history, and that's true across North America, of course. The difference, perhaps, in Canada is that there is not the sense that that situation has been resolved. In the United States, I think that white people tend to believe that that's been sorted out and dealt with. Whereas in Canada, I think people still understand that this is a process. It's still something that's happening now, dealing with the legacy of what was done to the First Nations people until quite recently.
You write, no one can disconnect themselves entirely from the world. We are all dependent, always. And you write, if we fail to build placefulness and community, well, then we all risk being homeless. They're very strong words. So can you talk me through that?
So it seems to me that the disconnection from place, that is the kind of predominant way of living within our society today is absolutely a problem for all kinds of reasons. I think that it does create social problems for people, and I think that it creates psychological problems. I think there's a sense that something is missing there in our disconnection from place.
What is Alaska like? I've always wanted to visit there, and I can imagine the light is only superb. And I suppose a lot of us in a lot of different ways have a very romanticized view of Alaska and where is a real Alaska, because we have pictures from books and from history. But it's changed a lot, and there's a lot of tourists in Alaska now, and you get a lot of kind of almost package tours, really. It's not the wilderness, or certainly not, it's not as wild as it used to be.
No, it's not. But Alaska is a huge, it's an enormous place, and a lot of it still is very, very wild. I mean, there are quite a lot of tourists, particularly around Anchorage and the southern part of Alaska. But you don't need to go very far to escape from that and to feel that you are in a place where human beings are almost not welcome, I suppose. But speaking about the light, you mentioned the light. One of the interesting things about this trip for me was how familiar the light was in all of these places, because, of course, that's the thing that places at the same latitude share, is that day length is the same all along the 60th parallel. And the light, for that reason, can be very similar. And so that particular thing felt quite familiar in all of these places.
You went fishing and you also went on a trek, which you got yourself involved with a bear. And, you quote, I think it was Jung you mentioned at some stage when he talks about how we've evolved in the world, that we lack the language to conceive the world and we've lost our instinct and our sense of reality. And you really wrestled with that when you came across this bear, didn't you?
I think what I wrestled with was that feeling that as soon as I left civilization, right, I suppose, in quote marks, a car park, and walked into the forest, I felt completely ignorant and therefore completely vulnerable. I didn't know how to deal with this place, and I didn't know how to deal with the information, the things that I was seeing and hearing around me. And so, although I knew where I was going, I felt lost somehow. And that was a very interesting and quite frightening experience, actually.
You write that fishing brings a change relationship with time. And you say something on the lines of, to fish is to be held in the heart of stillness, in which nothing is still. I thought that was beautiful, very poetic. Did you fish a lot when you were there? And also, presumably, you fished a lot in your childhood. Did you, Maliki?
I did fish a lot when I was growing up. I didn't fish very much on these journeys. That was perhaps the only time. But I have always found fishing to be a very interesting experience, partly for that reason, to do with time, where you are imagining what is about to happen or hoping for what is about to happen. And yet you're absolutely focused on the present moment. And yet at the same time, your mind is wandering and thinking about the past. And I find that more than perhaps anything else I do, time becomes kind of wrapped up in a very odd, fascinating way when you are fishing.
It's such an active but sublime discipline to have in life. But I imagine that most people have something in their lives that they experience that and that understanding of time in a different way when things become still and when things merge, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, perhaps they do. That's the only one I have, but I'm sure there are others. Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, in tonight's show, I'm talking with Scottish writer, musician and journalist Malachy Tallock, whose first book, 60 Degrees North, Around the World in Search of Home, has just been published by Polygon. Now, one of the more challenging locations that Malachy visits on the 60th parallel is Siberia, where Malachy writes, "On a map of the world, there are few names that carry such a heavy burden as Siberia. This is a region that lives in the mind, in daydream and in nightmare. It is more imagined than seen. And those imaginings, like a cloud of mirrors, reflect, disguise and distract from the land itself. This is a place almost lost behind its own myth." I asked Malachy to talk me through that.
Well, there are few places in the world, I suppose, where the name itself conjures up so many different images and ideas as Siberia. I mean, we hear that name and we immediately think of cold, we think of terrible things, we think of the gulags and that kind of awful history of the place. And so we have very little idea of what Siberia is actually like, because that myth and that idea is so large, so overwhelming.
You visited St. Petersburg and you present quite a snazzy and sophisticated picture of the city. And you spoke with local residents about the leadership of Vladimir Putin. He's an interesting guy, not a very likable guy, but he certainly is interesting as a political figure. And I think it was a guy that you're getting coffee from said she has something on the lines of, "Sometimes dictatorships work, sometimes you need that type of order." And I found that very challenging, but I was reading your book at the time when I was in Rwanda, which is under a very heavy-handed leadership of Paul Kagame. And in some ways, although I wasn't comfortable with it, it does make a lot of sense. And you can understand how in certain societies where a strong man is needed, whether that doesn't say that what they're doing is good, but that you need that heavy hand.
Yes, it's a tricky one, isn't it, for those of us who are used to democracies. But you can understand, in Russia, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you had chaos for years. I mean, you had complete chaos. It was everyone for themselves. And Putin emerged from that chaos and offered a kind of order that did seem appealing and still does seem appealing to an awful lot of people. Now, that's obviously problematic for many reasons, but it's understandable at the same time.
All men are created equal, but nowhere more than in the sauna. You write that in Finland. I travelled to Helsinki with my friend Suzanne there a while back ago. What did you make of the Finns? Because a lot of people find the Finns a bit standoffish and not very talkative. They take a bit of warming up, but they're lovely people.
Yes, the Finns have a reputation for being quite peculiar people. And I wonder if that's partly just that culturally and linguistically they are so different from other European countries. I mean, their language is not an Indo-European language. And for that reason, it can seem quite strange. But yeah, they have a reputation for being a bit cold and distant and wanting to be as far apart from one another as possible. And like all of these kind of national stereotypes, they only stand up to a certain extent. I mean, the people I met were very friendly and welcoming, and I very much enjoyed my time in Finland.
Well, whatever you think about their social skills or levels of charm, their right to roam laws are incredibly impressive, aren't they?
They are, though in fact those laws are very similar in throughout the Nordic countries and in Scotland too, that you can cross pretty much any land.
Did you read the Kavala by any chance, their big poem?
I read bits of it, but it is very big.
What did you make of it? Because it's pretty much central to their identity and culture. Every kid reads it at some stage, at a lot of wedding ceremonies and at funerals and so on. The words are jumped out.
Yeah, I mean, the poem has been hugely important in their sense of national identity, which is quite a recent... I mean, they're a very new nation. Finland only became a country in the 20th century. And that long poem, which was created out of traditional songs and poetry was fundamental in a lot of ways to the sort of national story that was created through the 19th century.
I was very interested in what you wrote about in relation to Sweden. And you bring up some writers, Henning Mankell, Stieg Larsson, a lot of famous Nordic noir writers. And Scandinavian crime writing presents a very rough, edgy, dark, gritty picture of crimes, drugs, prostitution, people trafficking and all sorts of stuff that people don't associate with the beautiful houses of Bergen and those lovely mountain landscapes and so on. So do you think that there are two worlds in some of the cities in Scandinavia, whether we look at Copenhagen or whether we look at Gothenburg in Denmark, that it's not a picture postcard as we think it is?
Well, it's not, of course. I mean, all of these places have this kind of dark underbelly to some extent. But at the same time, the interesting thing about the Nordic noir is that it is so at odds with what we see of the place. And not just that, but it's so odds with the actual crime statistics of these places. I mean, they have very low murder rates. In some ways, perhaps, it's that same kind of odd attraction we have to murder stories from otherwise kind of serene places. I suppose there's that sort of Midsummer Murders, and there's a series of TV programs about Shetland, of course. So maybe we are attracted for some reason to this idea of a darkness that exists within a pretty picture.
Presumably, you were spending a lot of time on your own and travelling through the range of different locations. Did you read a lot of the literature, whether it's contemporary fiction or some of the classics, as you were going through to build up maybe a kind of a psychological and social profile of the people? Or did you just say, scrap that and go with instinct?
I tried to read a mixture, I suppose, of writing about these people, particular places, but also writing from those places. So to try and get that mix of ideas.
But, you know, there's a lot to be said for turning up in some parts of the world and knowing the name of the airport or the main bus station or a train station or whatever it is, and just going for it. Because sometimes when we're armed with all these rough guides and lonely planets and the like, all we meet is tourists and all we see are these well-trodden paths. And there's no real discovery. By our prior knowledge, we're almost limiting ourselves to what can be discovered.
Yeah, that's true. And I suppose in some ways I was aided by the fact that most of the places that I went to were not places that had kind of long lists of sightseeing destinations. So once I'd been to the museum in town, I was kind of on my own after that. And in some ways, that did make it more of an exploration. It meant that I had to kind of force myself to look for the place in different ways.
I travelled around Morocco on €300 as a social experiment a couple of years ago for 2.5 weeks. So by definition, I was staying in pretty crummy places or people were putting me up, and I was hitching around. It made life very difficult, but it was a very interesting social and personal experiment.
I can imagine.
I had travelled around most parts of Africa before, so I was well equipped with what and where and how to go about things. But I sometimes think, dependent on a budget, sometimes the low budget can open up the world in so many different ways. You meet a lot of people, you have to rely on a lot of local information because you can't pick the fancy place to stay or the easy restaurant to find. So by being on a low budget, you have to really come to grips with a place to root around in order to get quality and bang for your buck, so to speak. So I'm just wondering, you know, what type of a budget were you operating on? Because you visited a lot of different locations and clearly some of them weren't as accessible as others. But within that, St. Petersburg would have been way more expensive, let's say, than some other places that you visited.
Yeah, I mean, I was travelling on a pretty low budget. I mean, I was paying my way. So I was sometimes staying in hostels and I was camping when I could camp. And yes, I absolutely agree. I think if you're on a lower budget, you inevitably encounter people who live there more than, of course, if you're going to luxury resorts and so on. I think if you're living off a similar amount of money to the people who actually live there, then you're going to encounter them more.
Yeah, but I suppose everyone has a different comfort level and what they're willing to do, because you do have to sometimes make lots of sacrifices, whether it's to do with sanitation, privacy and the like. You bring up American writer and academic Harry Page, and he thought that home was not just a kind of a place that we go to, but in some way it was a condition of the heart. I thought that was really beautiful. But it's there's a melancholic aspect to that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I suppose I chose that because it kind of fitted with the general feeling of the book and my own feelings about home, which are not simple, I suppose. They're kind of complicated feelings that I have about where home is and my own attachment to it.
Would it be fair to say, Malachy, that you found your way home through writing, that writing in some way has opened up the world and showed you what and where is important and what feels like home or what feels right?
I think what I found writing this book is that there are two answers to the question of where is home. One of them is a very long, complicated answer, and I suppose this book is my attempt to offer that answer. And the other is a simple one, because most people, if you ask them where is home, can give you that answer in a sentence or in a word or a couple of words. And by the end of writing it, I suppose I felt much more able to do that than I had in the past. If somebody asks me where is home, I will say Shetland. At the moment, I live in Glasgow, but if somebody asks me where is home, it's not Glasgow, it is Shetland.
Your late father looms largely over the book, and you write very beautifully on the nature of grief, Malachy. You write, "When my father died, I learned that loss is with us always. It is not a punctuating mark in our lives. It is not a momentary pause or ending. Loss is a constant force. Death is an ending and a continuation. Loss shapes us like a sculptor, carving out our form, and we feel each nick of the blade. But without it, we cannot be." I thought that was very beautiful and very, very profound. It's an extraordinary spacious way to look at grief.
Yeah. I mean, I lost my father died when I was 16, and inevitably that was a hugely significant moment in my life. The most significant, I suppose, in my memory. And of course, the idea of that loss does loom large for me. It is part of who I am. But it also did shape me. The person I became was shaped by that loss. So there are sort of two ways of looking at it. That's what I was getting at, I suppose.
Last question, and I'm going to end on a philosophical one, if that's okay. Do you think at some stage in all our lives, whether we're in our 20s, 30s, 70s or 80s, that we will cease to wander and that we will have that sense of home? Do you think that's possible for everybody?
It would be nice to think that, but I suspect not. I think that some people are very lucky and they don't have that longing for somewhere where they are not. But for a lot of people, that longing stays with them always. It becomes a part of who they are. And one of the interesting things going around speaking to people in bookshops and at festivals about this book is hearing other people's stories. And this sense of a longing for home seems to recur over and over in those stories that I've heard.
You say we're not like them a generation ago. We came on the same ships, we were heading below. We came is seeking protection away from the strife, away from the struggles and the hardships of life. Well, I'm not an incomer. My parents were ghosts. Sarah, I was born here. So where would I go?
Musician and journalist Malachy Talloch. Around the World in Search of Home is published by Polygon and retails for in around €10 in paperback. It's a smashing book, poetic and beautiful to dip into. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the stirring and beautiful words of Malachy Talloch from 60 Degrees North, Around the World in Search of Home. The ability to remember and to think, to imagine, are tied tightly together. They are the root of both our salvation and our fear, and one must be balanced by the other. In the coldest moments of winter, we can close our eyes and think back to sunshine, but such memories would be intolerable were it not for the vision of summer to come. And the belief, whether religious or scientific, that it will come. Fine words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.